The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, everyone. One of the, I think, important questions is how do we change, how do we change? For people involved in the spiritual life, how do we have spiritual change? How do we have personal change? Many people are looking to change something. They're suffering and they want to suffer less or not suffer at all. They feel dissatisfied with the life they're living and they want to change and do something else. So how does change happen? There are, probably many answers to that question. But there are two answers that are in my mind. One is through understanding. And to some degree, that's an important part of insight meditation because we're trying to see clearly and in seeing to understand something. And the other way is by how we're conditioned, the conditioning factors that affect us, the impressions that we take in. And that's what I want to talk about today because human minds can be shaped, human hearts can be shaped, can be conditioned. And if we don't somehow understand that, then we'll be conditioned by forces which are not our choice. And so we can also be participate in our conditioning and condition ourselves in a good way. So I thought of this topic because a few days ago I was talking with a group of people about perhaps an early conditioning I had. And then I started thinking about other conditionings I had that had an impact on me, shaped me. In the So in the context of the conversation I had, I was remembering that a very important experience I had as a child, and I don't know how old I was, but maybe I was 8, 9 or so, was laying in bed, going to sleep at night. And before I fell asleep, kind of through an act of, I guess, an imagination, imagining that I was looking out into the universe. And I was looking deep into dark space, and there were just a few scattered stars here and there. And for me, it was very comforting to have this view. And I would imagine what it would be like to die. And for me, I thought that when I die, that's it. I didn't think there was any continuation after death. However, at the same time, I felt that when I die, I'm going home into that universe. It's kind of like a return. And I felt very happy, like a homecoming. So I would have these, at night, going to sleep, periodically these thoughts, these images. And it was kind of, would it be comforting? It was very meaningful because many years later, I remembered those feelings I had, the feeling of being at home and comfortable and safe. And it was associated with being in this universe. And I think that having that repeatedly set an impression on me, a beneficial one, because when I started doing Buddhist practice, those memories came back. And as, not just as memories, but as a physical experience, my body, like my cells or my marrow, my bone, kind of knew this place of being at home in this universe, like this was here. So that was kind of a conditioning factor, something that infected me in a nice way. I remembered kind of somewhat similar, maybe around the same time, maybe it's not a, separate, so distinct from each other. Visiting my grandparents' house and being in bed in the morning, waking up. And back in, when I was, in Norway, people sleep with wonderful down comforters. And I remember waking up and it was, light was coming in, beautiful light was coming in through the window. And we had these wooden beds and wooden chairs. And it was kind of very simple Nordic little bedroom. And me being under my comforter. And I'd be awake and I'd be reading Donald Duck magazines. And my grandmother would come in to my bedroom with toast with cheese on it. And I think I just kind of took it for granted at the time. I didn't think about it much. I just, this is what was happening. Many years later, I said, you know, that was actually a very important experience. There was a feeling of being loved, of being safe, being comforting, being here, that actually I think helped shape me in some way. And, you know, I'd forgotten about it. And for me, some of these wonderful things that happened to me as a child were remembered through my meditation practice. Somehow by relaxing and settling, it came back. But at the same time, growing up, I had other conditioning factors that were not so good, right? So, I mean, when I was maybe about 7, I saw the only episode that I ever watched of Twilight Zone. So people who are old enough in America remember Twilight Zone. And it was a very scary TV show. And so I watched it only once in my whole life. But for the next maybe many months, I would go to bed afraid. Like, you know, it was like something scary was going to happen. It was kind of unsure what was going to happen, but it was, whatever it was scary. So I remember going to bed afraid. Or when I was 14, living in Italy, out on the street, a dark street at night, and alone, and then a man comes by and I get attacked. And so being attacked on the street, that had a big impact on me, and the fear stayed with me for a long time. And the fear was particularly, I didn't want to go back into town. We lived on the edges of town. So the idea of going back into town became scary for me. So that was a conditioning factor for me. And all the ones I've given you examples of are ones where there was an impression put on me, you know, in my marrow, in my emotional body, my sense, and it lingered and stayed with me. Some of the things that conditioning factors were more things that people said to me, and one that had no real physical impact on me, impression on my being. But it was an authority figure who said it, and so I just thought, oh, that's how, you know, I didn't feel strange about it, but that's true then. And that was my 7th grade art teacher looked over my shoulder as I was doing art in the classroom and said, "Gil, you have no artistic ability." You know, I had no self identity as having, you know, I didn't care about having artistic ability. It never occurred to me, and it just, oh, that's the way the universe is built, you know. Then, you know, just matter of fact. And so I just took that, you know, oh, it's the truth. So I carried with that without, I didn't have it feel bad about it. I just carried that with me until I got to college. And my roommate was, I don't think he'd call himself this, but maybe you get the sense, he was kind of a born-again artist. And so he kind of slowly worked on me. And by the end of my first year in college, I was taking art classes. And it turned out that I had some artistic ability. And so, you know, what the impact of what someone said, or when I was, I think it was about 14 or 15 also, I went to a boarding school up in the mountains. And turned out that I didn't know that until I got there. It was partly chosen because it's a beautiful mountain area with skiing and stuff. And it turned out it was a reformed school. People were sent from there from other boarding schools because they had, so it was an interesting place to be. And I was walking up in the mountain road with a friend and from school one day, and he was older than me. I was 14, 15, he was 17. And it was beautiful up in the mountains with blue sky and snow-capped mountains and valleys below. It was quite impressive. And it was kind of an environment where you would feel, well, I felt kind of awe. Kind of like, so I was walking in awe of this amazing natural setting. And I asked this question, you know, maybe innocent question, welling up from inside. Why are we here? And my friend said, "Don't be silly." And I felt shamed. I felt embarrassed. And something inside of me closed, and it took a long time before that opened again. And I've had that experience of being embarrassed or shamed and, like, you know, Not going to open that part again. So all these things are conditioning factors. And so some are good, conditions are beneficial and supportive, some are not. If we live in the memories of them in a certain way, we're reinforcing those things. So if we live in the memories of fear, we can be in some ways, it's easy to do, it's kind of like a natural, you know, it's, of course, you know, if it's a strong impression, but we then are subtly or not so subtly reinforcing those conditionings. You know, we're reminding ourselves to be afraid, and that's what goes in. If we can repeat the experience of being with a loving grandmother, repeat or even remembering those memories, that kind of conditions us or affects us emotionally in a different way. And so the question is, what conditions do we want to have conditioning us, shaping us? So part of Buddhist practice is to choose our conditions, be involved in helping create the right conditions. Not try to manipulate the situation, not to be overdo it, but we have some role involved. And if you are not involved in choosing what impressions you have, what conditions you, then so reality has lots of ideas for you. You know, you're just going to go along, and people around you, people are going to say things and do things, and people are going to, certain things will impact you and affect you. And it's quite powerful, the cultural and societal influences that affect us, and we take them in. So who you choose to be, spend time with, and the values they have and how they are. And so if you're with someone who's angry a lot, and it can affect you, and especially if you participate in that, then it touches places where you easily get angry, and so you're kind of reinforcing that. That's a conditioning factor, and it reinforces a certain way of being. So to look at our conditioning. So one of the purposes of Buddhist practice is not only to understand and to see, but to have conditioning so that we don't just have a good experience in and of itself, good meditation, but so that our meditation, so that our experience can affect us, can change us in some ways. And initially it might be small things. It might be a small change. But the repeated impressions we get make a difference for us. So sitting in meditation, and if you sit in meditation and spend a lot of time thinking and planning and remembering, then the quality or the impact of those plannings and those memories will have a certain impact on you. So if you're sitting in meditation, constantly wanting something, and you're in your thoughts of planning and wanting, it kind of reinforces wanting. It keeps you maybe in your thoughts, your imaginations, and your desires, and that has a certain effect on you. If you relax your thinking mind and don't get involved in thoughts so much, but rather you're focusing on being settled, relaxed, comfortable, feeling, recognizing perhaps that you're in your bedroom meditating and it's safe here and now and it's comfortable and you've had enough to eat and kind of take in the kind of goodness of the moment, that can affect you very differently. So part of the function of meditation is to have certain kind of well-being, ease, safety, confidence, openness that can, begin to change something. And that is very important to realize because it's not something, we have a role in creating the right conditions, the right impressions for us, but it has a very different way of changing us than us being the agent of change. I have to understand something, I have to figure something out, I have to kind of engineer and organize everything just to be the right way. There has to be a sense of receptivity. There has to be some kind of willingness to be open and receptive to something that's good. If you're out walking around in a very, very cold night and you're freezing and you come to your home and you look through the window and from outside and someone has the fireplace on, So that's great. You're so cold. So if you stand outside the window looking in at the fireplace burning, that's nice. it's pretty. It's a nice view and, something. But it's not going to help you get warm. You have to go inside into where the fireplace is and stand there and be close enough to receive the heat. The body has to take it in. So the same thing with impressions in our life. To allow them to let what's good come in. Take the time for it. Now, the suggestion I have is that most of us have many more good impressions coming in than we've taken time to feel and take in. Sometimes people are anxious. Sometimes people are full of desires and ambitions and plans they want to do and busy and important things to happen. Some people are lost in fantasy in their mind. And so whatever it is, they are so busy that they don't take the time to relax and be aware, be bodyfulness, have bodyfulness, mindfulness, and take in the goodness of this so it can have an impression on us, it can change us. It takes time to do this. We have to give a certain kind of time to take this in. Like this. This is how it is. If the mind is kind of continuously planning or thinking, we don't have a time to feel, to take it in. But as we take it in, something begins to shift and change. Something relaxes, something thaws, something opens. There's a message that can come into the kind of the marrow of our bone. Message of goodness, message of maybe feeling confident or safe or comfortable or sense of well-being in this world. That's hard to have if we spend time spinning out in fear and anxiety and our attention goes into thinking. This idea of how we are conditioned by things, and that's an important part of our life, is presented in the Buddha with the idea of the four, usually called the four nutriments, the four foods. So the four nutriments of life for human beings. And so it's an interesting list. And the first is edible food. That's obvious, right? The second is contact. Direct experience we can have of the world. The third is intentions, the intentions that we have. And the fourth is consciousness, knowing, how we know things. So those are the four. So food, sense contact, intention, and consciousness. The first one, edible food, we can certainly look at physically how it's nutriment for us, but to some degree, the associations we have with it, how we experience it, the direct experience of food, and not just the taste of it, but, there's a particular kind of Norwegian cheese, the kind of cheese my grandmother gave me, is called, it's a kind of brown goat cheese, which is kind of like the national food of Norway. It's kind of like, a higher class, kind of like peanut butter is in America, but a little bit higher class, if you're Norwegian. And for me, to have this brown goat cheese is comfort food. I have all these associations with it. So, yes, my grandmother's here again. This is nice. I try to give this my American friends, this goat cheese, and I still haven't met, I think, any friends who's willing to do more than a small little taste of it. It's not comforting for them. But oftentimes food have associated, it's not just the experience of it, the direct experience of it comes to the filter of our perceptions, our memories, our ideas of it, and certain foods can do more for us than just be, physically, good physical food. So the second thing is the sense contact and the whole sensory experience. And many, many things that we do have, maybe everything that we experience directly comes through our senses. And what do we allow to come into our senses? What comes into our senses? What comes into our senses can have a conditioning factor. If the sense experience coming in, the environment we're in is scary, agitating, that has a that it conditions us in some way. Maybe one little time you can kind of shake it off and leave it behind. But if it's constant over and over and over again, it begins kind of lingering and staying and shaping us. So it becomes kind of a lingering habit or a lingering kind of impression, view that we have of how we are. So what are the sense impressions that we allow ourselves to take in? I mean, sometimes the ordinary, everyday good impressions can have a very nice effect on us. If you come out of your house in the morning and it's a beautiful day, beautiful clear air and blue sky or some kind of weather that you like, if you can take the time to feel that and sense it and be with it, rather than looking out in the street and saying, you know, my car is kind of old and my neighbor has, you know, a Tesla and, you know, and, you know, I wonder how I should get a Tesla and I should get... You know, and I need to get a better job, and the job I have, you know, and then I should save some money, and I have to figure this out, and I have trouble with my finances, and someone didn't really raise me properly, and I better do some therapy. That chain of thought, whatever impression or conditioning factor that puts on you, you can decide for yourself, but what you've lost out on is the chance to kind of feel that, oh, at this moment, in this place, at this time, there's a feeling of just things are in place, things are right. The sun is shining, the sky is blue. Ah, that's nice. Isn't that nice? And something takes, we take something in. Sitting and meditating. Just the good fortune you have. I mean, not many people in the world don't have it. The good fortune of sitting down and meditating and closing your eyes and breathing in a relaxed way. That can be a very nice sense experience you can take in if you're able to stay present for it, the rhythm of breathing. But the mind wanders off. I've got to do therapy. I've got to get a Tesla. You know, come back. Just be here and take this in. Yeah. Take in these impressions. Are there some impressions that are sense experience that actually are very important for you to take in to experience? And actually, you should search them out. You know, so to be in an environment that feels nurturing for you, nourishing for you. It's a nutriment that you want to take in. I was invited on last Sunday to lead a guided meditation at the Windhover Center at Stanford University. They built a contemplative building at Stanford. I've never been inside, but that was kind of pretty cool. They'd built this to be for spiritual contemplation. And the lighting and the size of the space and the glass and, you know, everything was kind of like, oh, you go in there. It's like, oh, this is nice. When I was a child in Europe, I sometimes liked to go into cathedrals. And it was so nice to be there and feel it. In fact, there was one that... was one of these formative impacts on me. I don't know if anybody of you have been to a place in France called Mont Saint-Michel. It's a kind of a tourist spot, and I guess you drive across the plains of Normandy or Brittany, I forget where it is, and then driving along, suddenly there's this thing. It looked kind of like Disneyland castle. It kind of like on an island, it's a little on a hill, and there's this monastery. Religious buildings kind of built on top of the mountain and it kind of spires up into the sky. It's quite impressive. And it's famous because when the tide is low, it's connected to the land, but when the tide comes in and high, then it's an island. So I went in there, I went for one night, spent a night there on the island in a Pax Christi youth hostel. I loved it. Little place, and there was a priest there who took me in, and we all sat at a long wooden table with bread and probably wine, but, you know, and it was a lovely kind of feeling of spirituality to be there. And this priest took me and we went for a long walk in the evening and a nice time with him. And then the next morning I went to have a tour of this big cathedral, monastery, I guess. And we were walking around the whole place. I mean, some of it was pretty extravagant. But then we came in to where it had been, where was at the top of the hill, of the island. And there, in the middle of the whole big complex, was the original little chapel that had been built. It was still intact. Everything was built around it. They never took it away. And I don't know, there were probably eight of us in the little tour group, and we all fit in there, but it was relatively small. And I stepped into this chapel, and my whole being got deeply peaceful. And the peacefulness was throughout my chest, my chest and my rib cage, and my heart just felt like such a profound sense of ease and peace in this nice, cool, quiet stone chapel from over 1,000 years ago. And so when everyone left, I stayed behind, because this is something to take in, to experience. So, you know, sometimes we can go to places that have an impact on us that feels really good, that feels right, that this is what I want to be reminded of this. I want to have this impression on me. Some of you will watch the Super Bowl today. What impression will that have on you? When the Super Bowl is over, you know, what will that do to your, what kind of conditioning is that? And, you know, maybe, you know, it could be fun and nice, and that sense of lightness and relaxation and delight and joy of watching them might be great for you with friends or whatever. Or you, after it's over, you say, you know, well, if I'd gone to the Wendover Center in Stanford and spent those hours there instead, boy, that could have been nice. Or, you know, gone off to the look at the ocean from the beach, look at the beach in stormy weather, would be beautiful. One of the conditioning factors that has a big impact on my life, again, being Norwegian, I've spent a lot of time on the water, a lot of time on the edges of the water. And for me, there's something, when I look across water, especially water that's quiet, like if I go across the San Mateo Bridge, and I'm fortunate enough not to be driving, and if the bay is completely still, and occasionally going up one Highway 101, just before where just Candlestick Park used to be, and if it's completely still, something inside of me just kind of settles down. You know, and again, it's kind of like my being with my grandmother or something. It's like, you know, this, because I've been conditioned, I've had this over and over again, the sense of safety and calm and peace that I've taken in by being in nature. So what impressions do you give yourself? What impressions do you allow yourself to take in? And do you have the capacity, have you trained yourself to have the kind of mindfulness and awareness that allows yourself to take in the impressions that are good to take in? Certain kind of openness and receptivity. The third food the Buddha talked about is intention. And this is interesting that this is considered a food or nutriment, that what you want is a conditioning factor. What you want creates an impression, and especially repeated wanting of something over and over and over again. So, if you're constantly, so if you're lost in thought planning the future, there's actually a desire in those plans. There's an intention. And it might be interesting for you to go, you know, to look. And what is it you're trying to do? What are you wanting when you're thinking about the future? For some people, it's some variation of being safe. The desire to be safe. That's a good desire to have, for sure. But to constantly, over and over again, live in that desire for safety rather than feeling safety, is probably going to condition you not towards feeling safe, but might actually condition you to feel less and less safe because you're kind of lost in your thoughts. And, you know, you're actually not so safe when you're kind of lost there. If you spend your time complaining a lot, there's plenty of things in the world to complain about. There's no shortage. So, you know, and so if you decide to stop for a few days, you know, you're not going to lose the reasons to complain. So, you know, don't worry. But if you spend a lot of time complaining, it has a certain effect. It sets an impression on us. So complaining might be out of anger hostility, very, very mild maybe hostility. And that has a very different effect than looking at someone or remembering someone and rather than complaining about them, remembering their good qualities and sharing with someone. This is like, you know, wow, do you see what they did? They kind of helped their neighbor when the neighbor was sick. Now, we don't want to be Pollyannish and ignore, you know, what's difficult and challenging, but we don't have to give up, you know, we can give up complaining without being Pollyannish. And there might be more realistic ways of looking at the world than what we're seeing through by complaining. But complaining does have an intention in it, something we want. And so what is that? That has an effect on us. And the reason why I think it's so important to look at intentionality, what we want, is that it might condition us more deeply than sense impressions. And so, because it comes from our heart, it comes from deep inside of us. And Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis on the importance of intention, the motivations, the sense of purpose, the desires by which we live our lives. And to be very careful, very mindful of why you do what you do. Why do you say what you say? Why do you do what you do? Why do you think what you're thinking? To begin getting a handle on that and see it clearly gives you the opportunity to have more choice about the intentions that you want to live your life by. And the intentions that you live by create an impression, effect on you. Then more deeply, that intentionality is consciousness. It's a little bit difficult to kind of say exactly what consciousness is, but in Buddhism, consciousness is a way of knowing. And so, and there's many ways of knowing our experience in the world. But our knowing, consciousness as a way of knowing, is not neutral. Many times in the West, we think of consciousness as a neutral, innocent, receptivity, knowing, awareness of the world. But I don't think there is such a thing, that this, you know, that we have innocent perception of how things are. I read an article yesterday about there's a famous experiment or a little visual test where they have two parallel lines, or two lines next to each other, but then they have if it's an arrow, then there's a diagonal line on the top that goes back towards the base. And if you put another similar arrow in the other direction towards, so it's kind of like a diamond kind of, versus the other line, you do the diagonal lines in the other direction, going out like two hands up above the head stretched out in the V, and the bottom the same thing. And then you say, they're both the same length. And then you ask people, which is longer? Which is shorter? And it turns out that Americans will always choose the one with the sticking out like V as being the longer than the other one. But if you go around the world to different cultures, you get different answers. And there's some cultures where they always say, they're the same length. And it turns out that Americans, growing up in this culture, are the outliers, are the strange ones. And the researchers talk about how weird we are because we're the outliers of the outliers in terms of how we see. But the assumption had been for years that this is just part of optical illusion, that part of human, how the brain works. It turns out it's not an optical illusion. It's a culturally conditioned phenomenon. And the researchers said they claim it's because a lot of people in the West, they live in square boxes where there's a certain perceptual field that we see three-dimensionally that's very different than people who live like in the Amazon basin in the jungle. And the people in the Amazon see it more accurately than Americans. They see the equal length. So the idea that how we see is a neutral thing is not a Buddhist idea. The ways that we see. And so how we look at things. Do we look at it, you know, it's affected by intentionality, by our beliefs. We tend to notice certain things, you know. So how we look I remember when surprise I had when I was driving down El Camino many, many years ago. I think down through Mountain View or something. And we were shopping for a futon couch. And to my surprise, there were a lot of couch stores and furniture stores and futon stores. I had no idea that, you know, because I never noticed them. But now I was looking for them. So we're biased in how we know, what we look for, how we see. We look at a room, and you know, come into a room like this one here. Some people, how they know what's going on, is based on their conditioning in the past and their preferences and their feelings and everything. Some people notice the people. Some people notice the chairs. Some people notice where the escape routes are. You know, all kinds of things that people notice. And so part of mindfulness practice is not only to be mindful, but to pay attention to how we're mindful. Are we mindful? Are we straining? Is it work? Are we receptive? Are we open? Does the mind tend to go to certain things over and over and over again? Prioritize certain things. We have habits of how we know. And as we start to see these things and know these things, then we can have some ability to know in ways that are nourishing for us, that are supportive for us. There's ways of being mindful which are debilitating, and ways of being mindful which are nurturing and supportive. So to be careful how we know is part of this. So one of the ways that we change, have personal change and spiritual change, is a change that we support, not the change that we create, but the change that we support to happen by the conditions that we allow ourselves to receive, that we put ourselves in. And we have some choice about the conditions that we institute. We don't have universal choice. There's plenty of things which are not part of our control. But if you can prepare the ground so that you condition yourself in a useful way, in a good way, then when you go out into the world where it's maybe conflict and danger and you have to kind of act and do something, then perhaps you're conditioned to, you have a feeling at home in yourself, that you're less likely to be angry, less likely to be afraid, more likely to be confident, more likely to feel be courageous, more likely to be able to step into conflict. At the same time, you feel at home, feel at ease. Oh, here, I belong here. This is the place where I'm at rest and ease. It's okay. And not be swept into, you know, the kind of preoccupations that can make the whole thing more difficult. So what impressions do you allow yourself to experience? What choices do you make? How careful are you with this? Some people are over-careful. Some people are neurotically trying to set up everything so its conditions are just perfect. And even if you could be kind of successful in getting everything set up to be just perfect, it's probably not helpful. The example of this is I've known people who are Buddhist monastics, lived in monasteries for years. Some of them living far in the forest, away from cities and society. And they got pretty happy, relaxed, concentrated, peaceful. And they thought, I got it made. This is it. I've arrived. And then they went into Bangkok. And, their stuff comes up and, you know. So, you know, it's important to not hide from the world, not important not to avoid who we are and set up the conditions perfectly so we're just comfortable. That doesn't work either. But we can, within reason, begin being careful and choiceful, making choices about what are the conditions that we allow to condition us. And then as we get more and more conditioned in good ways, then at some point that supports deep understanding. And the deep understanding of insight meditation, the deep penetrating insight that's possible, is built on the foundation of having very good, kind of creating very good psychophysical conditions for stability, confidence, safety, ease, so that the inner eye, our inner perception, can see in an effective way. So I hope this was useful, give you something to think about. And it's something that if you find it kind of provocative, this idea, in one way or the other, it might be something that you spend some time talking to other people about. And so it kind of lives in you, and you think about it and reflect on it and with others and hear what they have to say. And it might give you something to do during halftime. Great, so thank you all very much.